Welcome to In Context Martin Luther King Day Special. Who Killed Martin? Who Killed Bobby? I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. The three most important political assassinations in modern American history were John F. Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States, Reverend Martin Luther King, whose memory the nation honors today, and Senator Robert F. Kennedy, President Kennedy's younger brother, who was murdered while campaigning for president. Last week on In Context, we focused on the 1963 murder of President Kennedy, while in today's program, we'll focus on the 1968 murders of Reverend King and Bobby Kennedy. We begin the program with my 2008 interview with William Pepper, author of The Execution of Martin Luther King. Mr. Pepper, who was an attorney, represented James Earl Ray in Mr. Ray's unsuccessful effort to withdraw his guilty plea in the King murder and obtain a trial. Mr. Pepper subsequently represented Martin Luther King's family in a civil wrongful death action against those believed to be responsible for Reverend King's murder. Following my discussion with Attorney Pepper, you will hear my 2009 interview with Shane O'Sullivan, author of Who Killed Bobby? Mr. O'Sullivan discusses important forensic evidence that was not considered in the original investigation of Senator Robert Kennedy's murder.
Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Pepper.
You're welcome.
Can you tell us when and where Martin Luther King was murdered?
Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee on the 4th of April, 1968 at approximately 1 minute past six.
And why was he in Memphis, Tennessee?
He was in Memphis, Tennessee to organize a march on behalf of the striking garbage workers. They had been on strike for a period of months, and it had polarized the Memphis community. Dr. King led a march on the 28th of March, which broke up into turbulence and violence, and he had to be rushed from the scene. Later, we learned that march was broken up by provocateurs who came from outside of Memphis, particularly from Chicago and St. Louis.
Now, while many Americans think of Martin Luther King principally as a civil rights leader, in the year before his death, he started to move into other areas. Can you talk about that?
Well, I only knew Martin King the last year of his life, and I came to know him when I came back from Vietnam. I'd been a journalist in Vietnam, and when I came back, I wrote one piece in particular that caught his attention. It had to do with Ramparts magazine, and it had to do with the effect of the war on the civilian population of Vietnam, most of whom were either under 15 years of age or elderly, and they were, of course, being slaughtered. That struck some of my photographs struck him, and so he asked to meet with me, and I worked with him then the last year of his life, and began pretty conclusively to turn him and see him turn into a more than a civil rights leader, and that had been the direction he'd been heading in anyway, but he now became a committed human rights advocate and an anti-war campaigner.
He made a famous speech at Riverside Church just a year before the assassination.
Yeah, 1 year to the day, April.
In which he declared his opposition to the war. He was also involved in a Poor People's Campaign that was going to have a demonstration in Washington that summer.
Yes, he was leaving Memphis, actually, to head into Mississippi and begin the mobilization of marchers into Washington, not for the purpose of holding a demonstration and marching, but for the purpose of living in an encampment inside Washington, the shadow of the Washington Memorial. So he was going to bring many, many thousands of people there for the purpose of taking up residence in the nation's capital and going up and visiting their Congress, the people on a daily basis, in an effort to try to press them to put back into the budget funds that had been taken out and were needed for social programs, but had been denied because of the war.
And there was also some talk that he might run for president in 68?
Yes, there was a very distinct movement, and that's really what became a major part of my activity. He asked me to head up a National Conference for New Politics, which was an umbrella organization of all the anti-war and peace activist movements throughout the country, including many sort of disenchanted Democrats, members of the Democratic Party, who wanted to see this war end. And And the idea was to form a ticket of Martin King and Dr. Benjamin Spock as a third party alternative and on an anti-war platform.
You note that in 1979, the House Select Committee on Assassinations found that the FBI had targeted Martin Luther King since the early 60s. Why was the FBI after Dr. King?
Hoover took a strong personal dislike to Dr. King, and of course, Hoover was looking for every opportunity he could to tie the civil rights movement and Martin King to communist influence in the Communist Party. This, of course, was an effort to divert, and successfully did for many years, divert attention away from Hoover's alliance with organized crime and his working relationship effectively with organized crime in the United States through being able to deny its existence, which he did for many, many years. And he targeted King and other civil rights leaders.
These activities included things like burglaries and wiretaps and infiltration.
Yes, the whole Quantelpro operation.
You mentioned that they even had an informant in his executive staff.
Yes, they had an informant who was handled by an agent out of the Atlanta field office.
Now, subsequent to the shooting of Dr. King on April 4th, who was arrested for the murder?
Well, James Earl Ray was arrested at Heathrow Airport in London and charged with the assassination. He had been well and duly set up, although none of us realized it at the time, and indeed I didn't realize it for 9 years. It took me 9 years. 9 years later, when Abernathy asked me to go interrogate Ray, that we began to really look at the serious possibility that the man was innocent.
How did he supposedly do the crime? Where was he shooting from?
Well, supposedly he committed the crime from a bathroom window, a rooming house that backed onto Mulberry Street and the Lorraine Motel. And supposedly, allegedly, he had rented the room and he just waited for Dr. King to appear. And then he shot him and fled down the stairway and out the front door, where he went a few feet south on Main Street, dropped the bundle in the doorway of an amusement parlor and record shop, and then got into a Mustang, drove away. Now, that was the story that of the actual killing that the government put forward.
And he did plead guilty subsequently.
He was coerced by his second lawyer, Percy Forman, who had promised him a trial, but at the end of the last minute, coerced him into copping a plea, saying they were going to fry him. The media had already convicted him, that his family would be harassed forever. But the main reason James told me that he finally decided just to plea was Forman said, look, my health is not good, and I can't give you your best defense. So just take this plea and then hire another lawyer, set it aside, and you'll be much better off.
Did Ray recant his plea?
Oh, sure. He always. I mean, he never actually said that he did it. He accepted legal responsibility in a series of checked stipulations. And James had 3 days after the sentencing hearing, he moved to set aside his guilty plea and to seek a trial.
Although the government claimed that Ray had committed the murder by shooting from a bathroom in a rooming house, several witnesses, you point out, appear to have seen gunfire coming from a bushy area instead.
Yeah, that's right. The area behind the rooming house, which is now, by the way, a museum, but the area behind that rooming house was overgrown with bushes and brush and massive amount of undergrowth there. And that's where the sniper actually lay in wait. And yes, he was seen by a number of people who independently reported seeing.
In addition, during the course of your representation, a judge ruled that the rifle that he allegedly used had not been sighted?
Yeah, it had not been sighted in, and it was off both to the left and too low, so it could not have been used in that murder. And in addition to that, of course, the state could not match any test fires from that rifle to the death slug.
Now, the rooming house was above a grill owned by a man named Lloyd Jowers, And in 1993, Mr. Jowers made a request for immunity to the Tennessee Attorney General. Can you talk about what he admitted to doing?
Yeah, Jowers initially just started off by admitting that he had been involved in a conspiracy, in the conspiracy to kill Dr. King, and he asked for immunity. He wasn't a good citizen. I mean, it's not something he did voluntarily out of the goodness of his heart. We had a number of witnesses, independent witnesses, who tied Lloyd Jowers to this killing. But he didn't know that he was going to not be indicted, and so he thought he'd asked his lawyer to get immunity for him.
And what was his involvement with respect to the rifle, with respect to the funds that may have been used for the assassination?
Well, Jowers received $100,000 in a delivery box, in a vegetable delivery box, which was routed to him by Frank Liberto, who was a lieutenant in the Carlos Marcello organization. He received that money in his grill, called Jim's Grill. His role was to accept and hold on to the murder weapon for a brief period of time, and then it was to basically be out in the back bushes area and to take the weapon from the shooter, which he did. And as he burst into the back of the kitchen with a still-smoking rifle, there was Betty Spates, who had been his mistress for a number of years, who had come looking for him. And she saw him rush by her, holding this gun, break it down, and wrap it into a towel. But she heard that only moments after she had heard the rifle shot. She was standing inside the kitchen. She heard the rifle.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we are commemorating Martin Luther King Day with a special program, Who Killed Martin? Who Killed Bobby?, in which we examine in detail the 1968 murders of Reverend Martin Luther King and Senator Robert F. Kennedy. This program will be archived for free listening at incontextreport.com, WPKN.org, and historycounts.org.
Now, he also made admissions to Dexter King and Andrew Young, not just about the money and the rifle, but about planning sessions that occurred in Jim's Grill involving Memphis Police Department personnel. Can you talk about that?
There were planning sessions in the grill. It involved a number of police officers in the Memphis Police Department, and Jowers admitted that they took place. So he was fully involved in this operation.
The Memphis Police Department failed to undertake certain security measures you mentioned when Dr. King came to Memphis on April 4th, including depriving him of his usual security guard of black detectives?
Yes, there was usually a group of detectives, poor black detectives, who had always watched out for Dr. King when he came to Memphis. And in this instance, they were not formed.
You also mentioned that the emergency tactical police units were pulled back from the Lorraine Motel, and that, curiously, two black firemen assigned to a firehouse overlooking the Lorraine were told not to report.
Yeah, there were the TAC-10 unit that had been stationed at the Lorraine was pulled back to the fire station, to the firehouse, which is on the corner of Mulberry and stretches up to South Main Street. They were pulled back there, out of the area, the immediate area. The two black firemen were instructed not to show up that day. They were removed from duty.
And it's not clear why Dr. King was assigned a room with a balcony.
His room was supposed to be down below in an alcove area. They switched his room virtually at the last minute and put him up in room 306, which was the balcony room overlooking the swimming pool, which, of course, was not in use. But he was in an ideally exposed position for the assassination.
Now, who was Frank Liberto, the man who gave Jowers the $100,000?
Frank Liberto, who arranged the funds, did not himself give them to him. He had them by a delivery person. Frank Liberto ran a food wholesale warehouse outside of downtown Memphis, and he was Marcello's man in Memphis. Very close connections with the police department because they were very much involved in illegal gambling and prostitution and drug running, the usual mob activities, and they needed protection, which they got. and Liberto was the guy who was assigned to carry out a lot of the work on the ground in terms of organizing the assassination.
Now, a man named John McFerrin gave evidence about a phone call that he heard just before the assassination, to be on April 4th, around 4:45 or 5 o'clock. Can you talk about what Mr. McFerrin says he heard?
He owned a small grocery store and gas station up in Somerville, about an hour from Memphis. And he would shop once a week at Liberto's warehouse and pick up his wholesale products. And he was in there on the day of the assassination, on April 4th in the afternoon, about an hour and a half before the killing. At one point when he was in the store, he heard Liberto on the telephone, screaming into the telephone, "Shoot the son of a bitch when he comes out on the balcony, and don't bring your ass around here. Go down to New Orleans and get the rest of your money from my brother."
Tell me about a man named Raul and what involvement he had.
Raul was James's handler. James had always said that he had a handler, and his name was Raul. And he'd been treated as some sort of fanciful figure, but we've pretty much established who he was, and the fact is that he did handle. He was James's handler. He did meet him in a bar up in Montreal as James was trying to leave the country. Remember, James was an escaped convict, and he was on the run trying to leave the country. And this guy, there are certain people had been helping him and steering him toward the Canadian docks in Montreal, and he was in this bar, and that's where this fellow Raul effectively picked him up, made contact with him, offered him a job, offered to buy him a car, and wanted to keep him on a string for making certain deliveries for him and running errands, at the end of which he promised him he would get him get travel documents for him.
Did Raul have anything to do with getting a rifle to the grill?
Yeah, I mean, Raul, of course, designated the rifle that James was to buy, and when James bought the wrong rifle, Raul sent him back, this was in Birmingham, to buy a 30-06, which he didn't buy the first time. And then Raul met him the night before the killing. He met him at the New Rebel Motel just outside of Memphis and took the rifle away from James. That was the last James saw the rifle. That rifle was the throwdown gun that was found in Knipe's doorway.
I see. And another gun was actually used for the assassination.
Oh, yes. No, yeah. That was just the throwdown gun.
Now Raul connects to Carlos Marcello through a gun-running operation that also connects the U.S. military. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, it was an interesting, almost convoluted connection. Around this time, there were a number of military bases and forts that were being looted of weapons, of armaments, and they were being often driven into Marcello's place on the water and put on a flatboat, shipped around into Houston, unloaded in Houston, repackaged by a team there, and Raul was part of that team, repackaged by a team there. In fact, this Raul led the team. And then they were being sold into Latin and South America. Two of the people who drove, two of the grunts, soldiers who drove the truck with weapons in, were a part of the sniper unit that was really coincidental, the sniper unit that was in Memphis as a backup unit.
Well, now, could you talk about the 902nd Military Intelligence Group and, in general, what the U.S. military domestic spy operations that they were involved in the years preceding the assassination?
Well, I think the military has been far more active and involved in domestic espionage and surveillance on American citizens than has ever been revealed. When Ramsey Clark would not sign an authorization for wiretapping on Dr. King and his residence and his church and so forth, Hoover then went to his buddies in military intelligence under Bill Yarborough, with the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, and they had the military involved in the surveillance of Dr. King. It was a very extensive operation. The Deuce was right in the middle of all of it.
You mentioned that the 902nd was deployed in small units throughout 67 and 68, and that they carried mug books of black leaders.
Yeah, that's what I was told, that they had small units often sniper units, and they carried mug books of community leaders who were deemed hostile and to be neutralized in one way or another.
Now some of your information about the 9/2 and the military involvement of the events of April the 4th comes from a man named Warren?
Those are pseudonyms. Warren and Murphy are pseudonyms. I try to protect people who are still alive, and certainly people who tried to provide us with information and help us. They're out of the country, and they provided information. They were members of the sniper unit. They provided information through Steve Tompkins, who the same journalist who became aware of their presence in Memphis.
Now, you say that Warren was a member of something called Alpha 184 Team. Can you talk about the activities of the team on April 4th?
It was an eight-man sniper unit that left Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and drove, left at about 5:30 in the morning and drove into Memphis. And various members of the unit took up their appointed positions. And their task was, so they thought, was to take out Andrew Young and Martin King. And Andrew Young was a bit of a surprise, but they had two sniper units, two sniper teams, and one of them, the one on top of the railroad building, was to take out Andrew Young. And that, they thought, was their job. And they were in position and ready to go. And then what happened was the sniper was a civilian sniper. And they were the backup, in my view, to that civilian sniper. The civilian sniper fired from the bushes and accomplished the task. And so they were not needed. They were told to disengage and withdraw.
Now, the King family in 97 came to support James Ray's legal maneuverings for a trial. What was the result of that?
There were two trials, that one can say, connected with this whole thing. One back in 93, which related to evidence that we had at the time, and it was actually a television trial, but it was unscripted, and it was bitterly fought with an independent jury and a former federal judge presiding. And that took that, with the minimum evidence we had at that time, it took that jury 7.5 hours to find James not guilty, which was a shock to Hickman Ewing, in particular, who was the prosecutor, and had former U.S. attorney in Memphis, and former, later to be a Ken Starr prosecutor against Bill Clinton. So that was one then, and that, by the way, opened the floodgates to a lot of information that we didn't have. Okay, the second trial, the one to which you're referring, was the civil trial, which was an actual civil trial.
So you chose a civil route then?
It was the civil route whereby the King family would sue Lloyd Jowers and others, including agents of the United States and agents of the state of Tennessee and city of Memphis, for conspiracy to kill Martin King. Jowers was the key defendant in that trial.
Did they seek damages, monetary?
No, they only sought, well, they did, but only to the extent that it was required to pay the burial costs.
And that trial?
The equivalent of the burial costs.
And that trial took place in 1999 in Memphis?
Yeah, it took place in 1999 in Memphis, and it lasted for 30 days. It had 70 witnesses. Probably never before in history has an assassination been so well documented and detailed under oath.
And what was the jury's verdict?
The jury found for the King family that a conspiracy existed and took them 59 minutes. And they only attributed 30% of the responsibility to Lloyd Jowers, and the rest they attributed to the government.
So they determined that Lloyd Jowers participated in the conspiracy, but that others, including government agencies, also participated.
Yes, absolutely.
And what was the media's reaction to the verdict?
Silence. The media's reaction to most things has been silence. There was one article in the New York Times, and then it went away. The media stayed in the hallway through most of the trial, not hearing the evidence. When Mrs. King testified, or Andrew Young, or Dexter, they came in to note of that testimony, but when the real hard evidence was being presented, they were, for the most part, not capable, not willing to report it. So most American people don't even know the trial took place.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we are commemorating Martin Luther King Day with a special program, Who Killed Martin? Who Killed Bobby? In which we examine in detail the 1968 murders of Reverend Martin Luther King and Senator Robert F. Kennedy. What you just heard was my 2008 interview with William Pepper, author of The Execution of Martin Luther King. Mr. Pepper, who was an attorney, represented James Earl Ray in Mr. Ray's unsuccessful effort to withdraw his guilty plea in the King murder and obtain a trial. Mr. Pepper subsequently represented Martin Luther King's family in a civil wrongful death action against those believed to be responsible for Reverend King's murder. We continue the program with my 2009 interview with Shane O'Sullivan, author of Who Killed Bobby? Mr. O'Sullivan discusses important forensic evidence that was not considered in the original investigation of Senator Robert Kennedy's murder. This program will be archived for free listening at incontextreport.com, wpkn.org, and historycounts.org.
This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In today's program, we're going to closely examine the evidence relating to the assassination of Senator Robert F. Kennedy. Is it really a closed case, or is there a need for a new public investigation? To help us examine the evidence, we're very fortunate to have with us today author and filmmaker Shane O'Sullivan. Mr. O'Sullivan spent 4 years reinvestigating the assassination, and he's the author of Who Killed Bobby? The Unsolved Murder of Robert F. Kennedy. He also directed the documentary film RFK Must Die. Mr. O'Sullivan, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello, Ken. Pleasure to be with you.
When and where was Senator Robert Kennedy assassinated?
Well, it was the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. It was the day of the election in California, the California primary, that was going to be pivotal in deciding whether he had a run at the presidency. And shortly after midnight on the 4th, going into June the 5th, 1968, shortly after giving his speech, he was assassinated in the pantry of the hotel.
Now, there's a lot of turmoil in the country at that time. In addition to this hotly contested race for the Democratic nomination for president in 1968, you had the Vietnam War at its height. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated a couple months before, and you also had racial riots across the United States.
That's right, and I think, you know, the feeling was that after the Tet Offensive in early 68, it seemed like the war wasn't winnable in Vietnam. Kennedy felt it was almost his duty to act and to shake up the government in power, which would have been LBJ at that time. So he made the decision to run for the presidency. A couple of weeks later, Johnson said he wasn't going to renew his bid for the presidency in 68. So it looked like Robert Kennedy had a very good chance to go up against Nixon for the White House. He was running on a platform to pull out of Vietnam, stop all the defense spending, and funnel it towards the war on poverty, which he'd been a major part of for the couple of years leading up to that. So he really became a voice of the anti-war movement and a voice of the students and a voice for the people to go up against the war machine at that time.
So he's at the Ambassador Hotel. There's a big party to celebrate his victory in the California primary. It's 12:14 a.m. He's given his victory speech. Could you take us through the events that follow the end of his speech?
He started giving a speech at 2 minutes past midnight, went on for roughly 10 minutes or so, and of course all the television cameras were there recording the speech and it going out live and so on. And then he was ushered off the stage in a different direction than his aides and bodyguards expected. So he was ushered off the back of the stage through a gold curtain by Carl Eucher, who was the maitre d' at the hotel. He went through the backstage area, and again, he turned right instead of left. So again, an unexpected kind of route switch a couple of minutes before the end of his speech sent him into the pantry. And there, waiting in the pantry, was Sirhan Sirhan. He stepped out and he fired at Kennedy, but we believe a second gunman may also have fired in the pantry, and that the story, the official story that's been presented for 40 years may not be quite as clear-cut as is portrayed.
Now, Eucher is leading Senator Kennedy through the pantry at the moment that Sirhan is shooting at Kennedy. What does Eucher do?
Well, basically, Eucher was an assistant maitre d' at the hotel. He led Kennedy into the pantry. There were up to 77 people in the pantry at the time of the actual shooting. So Eucher had a hold of Kennedy's right hand. He led him forward through the pantry. There were various kitchen staff and well-wishers trying to shake Kennedy's hand. And just before the shots rang out, Kennedy was shaking hands with a couple of busboys and waiters just by a steam table just halfway through the pantry. And then basically Sirhan had been waiting on top of a tray stacker, stepped off the tray stacker, walked over to where Eucher was, tried to reach around Eucher, brandishing a gun, and then started firing. So that's really the key moment, yeah.
And then Euchre does what? He goes after Sirhan?
Well, Euchre let go. Euchre was holding Kennedy's right hand with his left hand, so he released Kennedy's hand. And then after approximately two shots, according to Euchre, he grabbed Sirhan's gun arm and diverted it away from Kennedy. Now, that's very important because three shots hit Kennedy from behind. A fourth shot went through the shoulder pad of his coat. Yet here we have the witness who was closest to Kennedy and to Sirhan insisting that after two shots, he diverted Sirhan's gun arm away. So Sirhan's gun arm was no longer pointed at Kennedy and couldn't have made those three shots or four through the shoulder pad that the autopsy showed.
After the first couple of shots, Euchre has Sirhan's gun hand pressed down towards a steam table, which I understand is in the pantry, and Sirhan keeps firing even though he's being held by Euchre and Euchre's partner, Eddie Manasian.
That's right, yeah. Euchre basically grabbed Sirhan in a headlock with one arm and then diverted his gun arm with the other and basically tried to push Sirhan up onto the steam table, which both of them were basically standing alongside. And then there was a great struggle on the steam table. Sirhan seemed pumped up and very adrenalized, and it took five or six, quite burly bystanders and Kennedy bodyguards to try and wrestle the gun from him. So again, a suggestion that he wasn't in a fit mental state, or it was in quite a strange physical state at the time.
Now, according to the eyewitnesses, where was Sirhan standing in relation to Robert Kennedy when he made the shots?
Well, the key thing is that Sirhan was placed in front of Kennedy. The witness distances varied, but they were between the barrel of Sirhan's gun was 1.5 to 5 feet in front of Kennedy. Also, we have Euchre and Frank Burns, who was an aide to the Kennedy campaign, actually standing between Sirhan and Robert Kennedy. So that would seem to imply that he couldn't have got to the contact distance at which the shots were fired.
In fact, some of the eyewitnesses you cite, Valerie Schulte, gives Sirhan's distance at 9 feet. Pete Hamill, the writer, said 7 to 8 feet. Although they did go down, it seems like the average was in the 3 feet range. You had some that were even further away than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, some of the key witnesses who were literally right there and were standing between Sirhan and between Kennedy tended to say between, 1.5 to 3 feet. That was the distance between the barrel of the gun and Kennedy's head. But then you had other witnesses. Yeah, I mean, it went up to 9 feet, I think, in Valerie Schulte's case. But there was no single witness who placed the gun right next to Kennedy's head, as the autopsy would indicate. It must have been fired in that position.
And they also said that the gun was held how relative to the ground? Parallel to the ground or pointed down?
Well, this is it as well. So all the witnesses saw Sirhan's gun held roughly parallel to the ground, so on the horizontal, aiming at Kennedy, but again from this distance, muzzle distance of 1.5 to 5 feet. When you look at the autopsy results of Dr. Thomas Noguchi, he says that all three shots that hit Kennedy were fired from behind. The gun, because of the powder burns on Kennedy and on his coat, was held at contact distance, which means either contact with Kennedy's body or an inch away, and also in a sharp upward angle. So really steep upward angle, almost as if the gunman is in a crouched position below Kennedy at the time of shooting.
So the L.A. coroner, Dr. Thomas Noguchi, cited the three bullets where in relation to Senator Kennedy? The ones
that basically we have three shots that actually hit Robert Kennedy's body. One was fired an inch behind the right ear. It penetrated the brain and fragmented. So we had many bullet fragments literally in Kennedy's brain, and that was the fatal shot that killed the senator. And then we have a couple of other shots under the right armpit that seemed to be fired at a time when Kennedy's arm was raised, almost as if he had now heard the gunfire and was trying to react and take cover. So we'd never been able to determine what the order of the shots were in terms of when the fatal shot came in relation to the ones under the armpit, but certainly they came in a sharp upward trajectory from behind, and there were three of them. So if we believe Carl Euchre, it couldn't have been Sirhan who fired those shots because his arm was diverted away after the second shot. And also Sirhan was obviously in the wrong position because he was 1.5 to 5 feet in front of the senator, whereas the fatal shot seems to have come from 1 inch behind.
Mr. William Harper, who was a former technical investigation chief for the Office of Naval Intelligence, did his own investigation. And in December 1971, he wrote a report. What was his theory?
Well, his theory was that clearly there were two firing positions, because if you look objectively at the evidence, which I think is not something that the LAPD did at the time prior to the trial, you can see that, you know, we have Sirhan obviously seen by quite a number of witnesses firing his gun. I believe he did fire shots. We're not sure if any of them actually hit Kennedy, but there were five bystanders in the kitchen behind Kennedy and going back towards where in the direction where Kennedy had come from the stage, who were hit in various positions. Paul Schrade was hit in the head and nobody was killed, but there were five bystanders injured, and there were also a number of suspected bullet holes in the center post of the connecting door between the backstage area and the pantry, and so on and so forth. So it seems that Sirhan fired wildly in the direction of Kennedy, but may have missed Kennedy and basically fired at a number of bystanders and done some damage to the actual room itself, whereas the actual Kennedy shots seem to have come from behind. So, you know, 180 degrees different direction from Sirhan, firing in either direction, and obviously much closer to him than Sirhan was, according to the witnesses.
Could you tell us what Don Shulman, the TV employee who was standing behind Robert Kennedy, said about what he observed?
Well, again, if you go back to the audio tapes of Donald Shulman, he was recorded literally within 10, 20 minutes of the shooting, being interviewed by a radio reporter to give his view of what had happened. Again, in 71, he was debriefed by the DA's office, and again in 75. And he was very consistent, you know, each of the times that he was interviewed. He said that, you know, he didn't see an awful lot, but he's pretty sure what he saw. And standing behind Kennedy, he heard three shots. He saw three blood splotches erupting on the senator's body. And he saw a guard behind Kennedy firing three times. Of course, he didn't actually see Sirhan, but he also heard Sirhan firing from in front of the senator. But the key evidence that he contributes is that he saw three blood splotches erupting, from behind to Kennedy, and he saw a guard fire. So that links in with a security guard called Payne Eugene Caesar, who was actually along with Euchre guiding the senator through the pantry, and who was behind the senator and to his right at the time of the shooting. And he's always been the leading suspect in terms of the second gunman. And Don Shulman has always been one of the key witnesses to connect the security guard firing his gun, the position from which, the firing position B from which the Kennedy shot seemed to have come from, and the mystery around who else could have been firing in the pantry.
If you just joined us, you're listening to In Context on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Today we are commemorating Martin Luther King Day with a special program, Who Killed Martin? Who Killed Bobby? In which we examine in detail the 1968 murders of Reverend Martin Luther King and Senator Robert F. Kennedy. This program will be archived for free listening at incontextreport.com, wpkn.org, and historycounts.org.
Now, you talked about the number of bullets. Sirhan's 22 had 8 bullets, and yet five other people were wounded. There were four bullet holes in pantry doorway. You write about 2 holes in the ceiling, 3 bullets passing through the clothes of some of the witnesses. How was this problem advanced by Stanislaus Pruszynski's audio tape and its reexamination in 2005 by Phil Van Prague?
Well, basically, the Pruszynski recording was recorded by a Polish reporter, Stanislaus Pruszynski, on the night. So he followed Kennedy after the speech from the stage towards the pantry. He was roughly 40 feet away from the pantry at the time of the first shot, but then was rapidly moving towards the pantry with his recorder on during the shots themselves. So this is the first known recording of the actual gunshot that now we've come to know and actually does exist, but was buried in an archive for 40 years. And what that contributes is that, having been analyzed by Phil Van Prague, he's found that there are just over 5 seconds of shots on the recording. And analyzing them, he's found that there are 13 gunshots or shot sounds on the recording, and they seem to be coming from 2 different positions, 8 in front of the senator, which would be Sirhan's position, and at least 5 from behind, which fits in with, you know, both Harper's report, firing position A of Sirhan and firing position B of the security guard, and all of this other damage in the pantry itself. Because if you look at the 3 shots that went through Kennedy, the 4th that went through his shoulder pad, the 5 bystanders that were injured, 4 or 5 suspected bullet holes you know, in the immediate environment of the shooting. Then if we put that together with the 13 shots heard on the tape, it begins to make sense and we begin to have a clearer picture.
He also noted, you say, that there seemed to be a pause after the second shot, which was when Euchre said he grabbed Sirhan Sirhan's gun hand.
Exactly. It's extraordinary the work that Phil Van Praagh did, because, you know, there was a natural pause after two of these shot sounds, and that would seem to indicate that, you know, Euchre had, at this point, grabbed Sirhan's gun arm, diverted it away, then Sirhan continued to fire as he struggled with the Euchre, but then also perhaps a burst of gunfire started from behind Kennedy, and those were the shots that actually killed the senator.
Now, this audio aspect was also examined by Phil Spangenberger, a firearms expert, who tested the .22 Ivor Johnson Cadet, that type of weapon that Sirhan Sirhan used. And he focused on the time in between shots. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, one of the key findings of Phil Van Praagh was he found a couple of instances of double shots. These were shots on the recording which seemed to be fired so quickly that they couldn't have been fired by the same gun. So the interval between the shots was too quick for consecutive firing from the same gun, indicating that a second gun was used, at least in those two double shots instances. So basically, all of this was presented in a Discovery Times Channel documentary that was presented last year. And Phil Spangenberger was a firearms expert who basically took the same model of gun, tried to fire it as quick as he could, and basically the results of that test corroborated the findings of Van Praagh that in these double shot instances, these two shot sounds must have been fired from different guns within the pantry. So again, that kind of solidified the emerging picture of two guns fired in the pantry and 13 shots from two different firearms connected with this assassination.
The firearms expert said that there was only a tenth of a second between some of these shots, and it was impossible to fire this .22 pistol with less than a half a second between shots.
I think the closest he got was, you know, three times the interval of some of these double-shot occurrences. So it was just physically impossible, even for an expert, to fire the gun that quickly. And Sirhan, you know, at the time was no expert either. I think he'd bought the gun the previous March, and he'd basically gone to a firing range maybe half a dozen times in the lead-up to the shooting. So he was no sharp shooter. So, you know, if an expert like Spangenberger couldn't make that interval, there's no way Sirhan could have. With obviously Euchre and various that are struggling with them for control of the gun at the same time.
Now, we've talked in great deal about the ballistic and autopsy evidence, but this was not gone into in great detail, I understand, during the trial of Sirhan, because the issue there was primarily whether he was mentally impaired.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a big problem with Sirhan's trial because, first of all, the lead attorney was busy with another case and was very poorly prepared and didn't have much time to actually prepare the case in advance of the trial, which was delayed until January, February 1969. So basically, he stipulated to the ballistics evidence. He basically said to the police, okay, whatever you found in terms of the ballistics, I'll believe you. I'm not going to check it myself. I'm not going to put on a case on the ballistics in open court. I'm just going to look at diminished capacity. That was the tack he took, which was basically trying to prove that Sirhan at the time of the shooting had diminished capacity, wasn't in control of his senses, and therefore should be given a charge of manslaughter or a second-degree murder. And the thinking was, well, at least this will save Sirhan's life.
And many witnesses tell about seeing a girl in a white dress with black polka dots in the company of Sirhan. Could you talk in particular about the eyewitness account of Sandra Serrano?
Sure. So Sandra Serrano was a young Kennedy volunteer. She was 20 years old at the time, and she was sitting on a fire escape at the time of the shooting. And she's very curious because she was sitting on the fire escape, and about 20 minutes before the shooting, this girl in a white dress with black polka dots came up the fire escape with a tall Mexican-American in a gold sweater and a shorter, scruffy-looking guy who later Serrano put together with Sirhan's description. Then shortly after the shooting, the Mexican-American in the gold sweater, the girl in the white dress with the black polka dots, came racing down the fire escape, saying, "We shot him, we shot him." Serrano asked, "Who did you shoot?" And they shot, we shot Kennedy. And then they ran away. You know, this was the key evidence of conspirators conspiring with Sirhan at the time of the shooting. A Sirhan lookalike, according to Serrano, walked up the fire escape prior to the shooting and didn't come down because obviously he'd been apprehended in the pantry. You put Serrano's account together with Vincent DiPiero, who's another witness within the pantry itself, who, as he was walking into the pantry behind the senator just prior to the shooting, spotted Sirhan standing on the tray stacker, and behind Sirhan was a girl in a white dress with black polka dots. He gave a very similar description to the description Serrano gave of this girl, and Sirhan and this girl appeared to be smiling at each other. And then while Kennedy was shaking hands with the busboys and the waiters, Sirhan stepped off the tray stacker, went over and started firing in Kennedy's direction, and the girl in the white dress with black polka dots left the scene. So, you know, a key investigation undertaken by the police in the days and weeks after the assassination was basically trying to get rid of these accounts, problematic accounts of DiPiero and Serrano, who seemed to indicate that there was somebody conspiring with Sirhan in the pantry and fleeing afterwards.
And Sandra Serrano's account was also supported by a police sergeant named Paul Chiraga, who encountered a couple named the Bernsteins. Could you talk about his encounter with the Bernsteins?
That's right. Well, I mean, it's remarkably consistent, the descriptions of the girl given by these witnesses, and also the flow of action. I mean, we have DiPiero in the pantry seeing the girl with Sirhan, then we have the girl leaving the pantry, running down the fire escape with her Mexican-American accomplice, and then at the bottom of the fire escape was a parking lot into which Sergeant Paul Chiraga had pulled in his patrol car as one of the first police officers to arrive at the scene and set up a command post. And shortly after doing that, you know, just literally within 10 minutes of the shooting, a Jewish couple called the Bernsteins came up to Chiraga in an agitated state, saying again that they'd seen this girl in a white dress with black polka dots with an accomplice, saying the same thing Serrano had heard. You know, we've shot him, we shot him, we shot the senator. There's also another witness, a younger 15-year-old girl called Katie Keir, who again, from her description, seems to have encountered the girl and her accomplice saying very similar things, almost word perfect, the same utterances from this girl, somewhere between where Serrano saw the girl in polka dot dress and where the Bernsteins later saw her at the bottom of the fire escape. So here we have four witnesses, each of whom saw this strange behavior, saw a very similar girl in polka dot dress, but a girl in polka dot dress that the police tried to make disappear as soon as possible during their investigation.
Talking about the police and the investigation, you note that Lieutenant Manuel Pena, who was in charge of the investigation, handpicked by the Los Angeles Police Department chief to do so, had done special assignments for the Central Intelligence Agency in Latin America.
Yeah, I mean, there were two key LAPD officers basically taking day-to-day control of this investigation. One was Manuel Pena, and the other was Sergeant Enrique Hernandez, who was the polygraph operator at the LAPD. And basically, they set out their strategy in terms of what they wanted to investigate and what kind of leads they wanted to shut down. And one of the key leads they wanted to shut down was a girl in polka dot dress. So Serrano was subjected to, you know, outright bullying tactics by Hernandez during her polygraph with him. He got her to try and change her story, got her, you know, called her a liar, threatened her in all kinds of ways. We still have audio tapes of that recording. So basically, he was there to shut down Serrano, to shut down DiPiero, and over him, overseeing the broader investigation, was Manuel Pena. Both of these gentlemen were Hispanic, so they had been called on by the CIA and the Agency for International Development, which provided cover for CIA operatives at that time in the 60s, to go on these sabbaticals from LAPD and do various operations in Central and South America. So that's documented. Hernandez was there in 1963 in Venezuela. Pena also did sorties for the State Department and AID in the late 60s. So their links to Washington and their links to covert intelligence work overseas was something that came out in the early 70s and would cause, you know, quite a bit of worry as to their objectivity in terms of properly pursuing the leads in this investigation.
Now, a prominent psychiatrist at Columbia University named Dr. Herbert Siegel studied the Sirhan case carefully. Can you talk about his hypothesis and how it relates to the woman in the polka dot dress?
Well, Dr. Siegel, as you know, he's been at Columbia University almost 50 years looking at elements of hypnosis and how hypnotic programming can be used to enact pre-programmed behavior in hypnotizable people. And what he found is that Sirhan was a very hypnotizable person. Dr. Spiegel actually devised a grading scale in terms of how hypnotizable people are. And Sirhan is one of only 5% of the population who is a very hypnotizable subject. So he's quite suggestible. If he's given a program to act out, he will then do it once triggered. You know, the trigger could be an image of Robert Kennedy. The trigger could be a cue word given by a girl in the polka dot dress. But once he's put in the physical position to enact a program, and then he's put into a trance, he will then act out the program as programmed by, you know, any of these rogue doctors who were working for the CIA on these kind of programs at the time. So the thinking of Dr. Spiegel is that Sirhan was basically a hypno-programmed assassin. He was put in place in league with the girl in the polka dot dress. The girl in the polka dot dress was the trigger, so that when Kennedy emerged from giving his speech and walked into the pantry, the girl in the polka dot dress could communicate the cue word to Sirhan, and Sirhan then would see Kennedy. He had been conditioned to feel that Kennedy was going to sell bombers to Israel and drop them on the Palestinian people, which is the nationality of Sirhan himself. And then this anger would fuel his acting out this program to fire a gun and try and kill Robert Kennedy.
Now, it's been over 40 years since the Senator Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles. Is it still important for the public to know the truth? And if so, why?
Well, I feel, you know, it was a pivotal moment in terms of U.S. politics. You know, it obviously ushered in the Nixon years and Watergate and changed the direction of public life in America for many years after that. I think on the basis of this evidence, you know, it's important that your contemporary history, the record is set straight as to what actually happened to Bobby Kennedy. I mean, he could really have changed the country, and he's the hope of many people at that time. But also on a personal level, I think, you know, we have a guy in Corcoran Prison in a high security wing next to Charles Manson, who really has never had a fair hearing in court. He has no memory of the shooting for the last 40 years, and this new evidence that's been uncovered seems to indicate that he wasn't the one who fired at Robert Kennedy. So I think purely in terms of human rights or criminal justice, the investigation is not safe and needs to be reopened.
Thanks very much for being with us today, Mr. O'Sullivan. We've been speaking with Shane O'Sullivan, author of Who Killed Bobby? The Unsolved Murder of Robert F. Kennedy. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. It's clear that Sirhan shot at Senator Robert Kennedy, but even the evidence available in 1968 indicated the bullets which killed Senator Kennedy were fired by another gunman standing close behind Kennedy. So why didn't Sirhan's lawyers put up a more aggressive defense? The following may help explain. At the time of his appointment, Sirhan's chief defense counsel, Grant Cooper, was also representing Mafia Don Johnny Roselli in a well-publicized gambling case. According to Lamar Waldron, author of Legacy of Secrets, recent evidence, including material from FBI files, conclusively establishes that Johnny Roselli participated in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963. Additionally, Russell Parsons, an attorney picked by Cooper to help him defend Sirhan, was investigated by Robert Kennedy for mob ties when Kennedy was a young investigator for the Senate Rackets Committee. Referring to Kennedy in profanities, Parson reportedly later said he never forgave Bobby Kennedy for investigating him. Now, as to Professor Spiegel's theory that Sirhan may have been hypnotically programmed to murder Senator Kennedy, Mr. O'Sullivan notes the following. During the 1950s, the CIA was researching mind control under secret programs named Bluebird, Artichoke, and MKUltra. According to Mr. O'Sullivan, these CIA programs included research on hypnotic programming and the possibility of creating a programmed assassin.
You're listening to In Context, and we've been examining the 1968 murders of Reverend Martin Luther King and Senator Robert F. Kennedy. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. In Context, which is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., is broadcast on WPKN 89.5 FM on Mondays from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month. Our website is incontextreport.com. Visit In Context on Facebook and watch our videos on our YouTube channel, In Context Radio and TV. Programs stream at WPKN.org, and you can listen for free to an archive of this show on incontextreport.com, WPKN.org, and historycounts.org. You can email me at ken@mdrtalk.org. Thanks for listening, and have a good Martin Luther King Day.